Okay. Okay, we could start. Thanks for showing up on this rainy day. I didn't get nearly as far with the lecture last time as I had wanted to. So today I'm going to be talking about the 1920s as a whole. What was the point of the lecture last time? The point was that there was a struggle over the system established by the Treaty of Versailles. The essence of that system was that it set up a set of constraints that limited German power, because in the absence of those constraints, Germany would be not just the number one power in Europe, but so much stronger than any of the other powers that other countries like France would end up being, in effect, German satellites. Right? The point of the lecture was, can you blame the Germans for wanting to throw off what they called the shackles of Versailles, for getting rid of these constraints on their power? Isn't it natural for a country to want to have some control over its own destiny, especially for a great nation, to not want to be so totally at the mercy of other powers? Right? It's natural for Germany to want to do that, and then when you take into account all these moral considerations, the fact that the justification for these constraints on German power was the idea that Germany was uniquely responsible for the war, that Germany was a criminal nation and had committed this crime and deserved to be punished for it, a point that was embodied in the treaty, in Article 231 of the treaty. This was the so-called war guilt clause. It was very natural, normal for Germany to want to resist. On the other hand, can you blame the French for wanting to maintain the Versailles system? For not wanting to allow Germany to reemerge not just as the number one power in Europe the way she had been in 1914, but relatively stronger still? If you're willing to do that, what was the point of fighting the war? So it's natural, normal, built into the very structure of things for the French to resist these German aspirations. Right? It's a political conflict. It's not to be understood in moral terms. Yeah.
That's the one thing I'm unclear on. If it's a political conflict and this was all about keeping Germany from regaining her power after, how can we say that it was also a moral, how can Kennan say that America's moral considerations kind of caused the whole issue we had later?
Because Kennan is saying it was America's unwillingness to think in power political terms. We're talking now about the French. The French, because of their geographical situation, their geopolitical situation, they're obliged to think in these terms. The Americans aren't. Kennan is criticizing U.S. policy, Wilson's policy, for being excessively moralistic. And you could do the thought experiment of, suppose the U.S. government had thought in power political terms, had bought into this whole way of thinking, you know, that the key thing is to deal with German power in such a way as to provide some elements of security for Germany's neighbors, right? If that had been the case, then the United States would have done after World War I what she did after World War II, namely, stay in Europe, commit American power to the defense of Western Europe, maintain the bloc of the three Western democracies. If America had remained in Europe along with the British, then the bloc of the three Western democracies is so much stronger than Germany that France wouldn't have anything to fear. You can ease up on the constraints, allow Germany to recover her political rights, have a real reconciliation with Germany, and so on. Much more stable system if you thought in geopolitical terms. Okay, so that's where the Kennan argument is taking you to. All right? But the Americans are unwilling to do that. they have this moralistic notion of, Germany's this criminal country. There's the American notion during the war. They're uniquely responsible for the war. We'll come in, we'll slay the dragon, and then we'll go home. You know, it's all about the past. It's all about punishing Germany for what she had done. It's not about the future. Not about how to create a stable system. Because for Wilson, this whole notion of stability and balance of power and power politics and structure of power and all that stuff, this is the problem. The problem is that people thought in those terms. You had to think in terms of moral principles, doing what's right and so on. All right. So then the Kennan argument is that you can sympathize with Wilson. Everyone wants justice. Everyone wants to do the right thing. You know, moral considerations are foremost in people's minds. But you gotta grow up and not think exclusively in those terms, because if you do, it just paves the way to disaster. You know, you look at the great disasters of the interwar period. You know, just a decade later, and we'll talk about this today, the whole Versailles system collapses. 2 decades later, you have this new, much more dangerous war with Hitler breaking out. Could it have been prevented? And the realists, people like Kennan, say, you're damn right it could have been prevented. All we need is for more brain power to be at the heart of our foreign policy. America, you know, it's a very powerful country, but it's like some primitive dinosaur, you know, that slushes around in its primeval mud, and you can't get it to do anything until you practically bang it on its head with a 2x4, and then it just runs crazy and goes wild and destroys everything in its immediate neighborhood. Can't we do things in a better way? All right, that's what Kennan is saying. He says, and we better learn how to do things in a better way, because the problems we're going to have to face, and this thing was written in 1950, the problems we're going to have to face in the future are going to be much, much greater than what we've had to face in the past. He's thinking of, you know, the Cold War, nuclear weapons, and so on. You know, it's like, we can't afford to indulge ourselves in this Wilsonian nonsense. That's the Kennan view, right? So there's, right, and the French are inclined to think in realist terms. Okay. So what's the point of that analysis? If you can't blame Germany, and you can't blame France, then these international problems are not to be understood in terms of who's to be blamed, who's guilty, who's morally responsible, who's the aggressor, who should we point the finger at, right? You have to see them as built into the very structure of things, right? It's natural, it's normal, given the geopolitical conjuncture, for there to have been a conflict of this sort. Now, those are very important conclusions from the theoretical point of view, right? Because there's so much at variance with what we've been led to believe. You know, we're led to believe that, well, how do you conduct foreign policy? You figure out what's right. You orient your foreign policy to achieving these moral goals, ideological goals. You don't want to think in terms of, you know, power, political interest. There's something kind of very distasteful about that. You know, and the lessons to be drawn, at least by a lot of people who are realist men, those lessons be drawn pointing in exactly the opposite direction. Very important conclusions, because they're counterintuitive. They run counter to what you had been led to believe, in high school, all these ideas that you absorb from the general culture. Okay, so that was what I talked about mostly last time. And then, you know, that was just the aim there, was just to kind of set the stage. And it's like, how did all this stuff work out in practice, right? And what does a detailed analysis of the story of great power politics during this period tell us about these fundamental issues that international relations theorists are concerned with, right? And so we're just about beginning to shift gears and take a close look at the key issue that lay at the heart of this conflict between France and Germany, this conflict over the Versailles system, this conflict over the question of whose power would dominate Europe. Because you can't say that nobody's power would dominate Europe, because either you're going to have constraints on German power or you aren't. If you don't have constraints on German power, it's going to be Germany that's going to dominate Europe. And if you want to prevent that, France has to have dominant power to keep Germany from throwing off the constraints. Right? That's the real issue here. And the conflict is fought out over the reparation question. You know, Germany had, the war had been fought not in Germany. Germany basically threw up her hands before German territory was touched. Germany had promised, as a condition of peace, to pay compensation for the damage that had been done to the civilian population of the Allied states. And so there were these reparation provisions that had been put into the Treaty of Versailles. We saw how they were put in. Right. Why do the Germans resist the reparations? Because they're cheapskates and don't want to pay? No. They resist the reparations because the reparations are tied very explicitly to the notion of Germany's war guilt. As a matter of fact, it's famous Article 231, the War Guilt Clause, was the first clause in the whole reparation section of the treaty. But the fundamental reason they're resisting is that it's through concentrating on the reparations that they can most effectively move toward dismantling the Versailles system. They want to attack the system, and not in this kind of mindless way where they resist everything, you know, without regard to a strategy. They want to concentrate their resistance on the areas where they're going to get where it's going to be easiest for that policy to be successful, where there's the most sympathy in the West for Germany to not pay the reparations, where the reparations are technically most difficult to enforce. And in fact, there was a lot of sympathy in the West, in large part because of that just sensational book that John Maynard Keynes published at the end of 1919, The Economic Consequences of the Peace, in which he basically said Germany can't pay, right? For a lot of feeling that the reparations are impossible, that these demands so far exceed German capacity to pay that the only reason for enforcing them is giving the French some sort of excuse for putting the knife to Germany's throat. You know, this whole thing just will lead to endless instability, endless economic dislocation, so on. You got to change things in a fundamental way. And that was the context within which Germany worked. There was this, and then it was related to this broader context of, you know, liberal opinion, especially in the United States and Britain, was deeply averse to the whole idea that the peace should be enforced, that military power would play a central role in the post-war political system because of the need to enforce peace terms on a German state that was unwilling to accept them really voluntarily. All right, so the Germans resist. And the French are, what's the French reaction? Okay, now there's a standard view, and you still find it in the textbooks. The standard view is the French were pursuing a vengeful policy. They were insisting on very harsh reparation settlements that they wanted to kind of keep Germany down by demanding that the Germans pay impossible reparations and so on. Right? And again, those historical interpretations have a certain resonance in the context of international relations theory. Okay, what's the resonance that they have? This is the whole notion that if you want to understand what's wrong with things, why there's instability, why you don't have a perfectly, you know, rock solid peace, you got to figure out who's to blame. Who should we point the finger at? And in this case, you know, these liberals are not going to point the finger at themselves for insisting on a punitive peace, even though that was part and parcel of their philosophy during the war. Right, they're going to say it's all the fault of the French. But Wilson wasn't responsible. He was defeated at Paris Peace Conference. Treaty of Versailles was not in line with the Wilson program. You know, even the British. You know, oh, it's not our fault. It's just the fault of these terrible French. If that interpretation were valid, well, then that would provide, you know, important support for the kind of liberal worldview. Yeah, if you know, the instability has to do with, you know, this kind of bad, vindictive, punitive, cruel policy, right? So figuring out what the problem is really does boil down to an exercise in who should you point the finger, right? Does that view stand up in the light of the evidence? The answer here, and this was a big surprise for me when I started working in this area. This was my PhD dissertation. I did this work basically in 1971, and I had bought into the conventional interpretation, and you just start reading the documents, and lo and behold, it's, you know, the truth is like practically the opposite. Were the French vindictive? Well, we saw at the peace conference that they actually wanted a reasonable settlement. That they and the Americans had agreed on a figure. That they, in fact, were willing to go further than the Americans in reducing the amount that Germany would pay. To a sum that was equivalent, you know, the figure that they agreed to with the Americans, something like 6% of German national income. You know, it's a significant sum, but by no means beyond the capacity of a country to pay that no longer had to support a major military establishment, especially. And then even when they said, we're willing to go back to a strict reading of the 14 points and forget about the pensions and just limit the bill to the restoration of the devastated areas, that would have been $20 billion, 4% of German national income. You know, by no means, you know, an astronomical figure, an impossible figure. They wanted a realistic settlement. They, in fact, at the peace conference, approached the Germans and said, maybe you and we have a whole lot more in common than we had thought. We should come together and form a, you know, continental European bloc, practically, to, you know, stand up to the Anglo-Saxons. You know, it's like the kind of stuff that you saw, we will see after World War II, you know, the building of Europe, the building of a unified continental Western Europe. This has its origins in the post-World War I period in major ways that have scarcely been recognized. Yes?
If the French offered that to Germany, why didn't Germany take it?
A very good point. Did everyone hear that? Did you hear that in the back? She says, well, if this is the French offer, why don't the Germans take it? Good. I mean, it's a terrific point. And the answer there is there were an awful lot of Germans who wanted to respond favorably in positions of power. We're going to see this. I don't know what they amounted to proportionally, 30-40% of the Germans. But these were people who eventually came to power in Germany after World War II. The whole dominant group within the Federal Republic, especially in the conservative parties, the Catholic elements within Germany after World War II, people like Adenauer, the founding chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany. Adenauer, he was an old man after World War II. He was quite prominent in the 20s. He was a mayor of Cologne. People like Adenauer were very much concerned with mending fences with France, in large part because they were concerned about the Soviet threat, but they also wanted to kind of have the West Europeans come together so that they could stand up to Britain and America. To this day, you go over to Europe and talk with these people, they do not have a high regard for American culture, to put it mildly, and they don't like the idea of just being totally under America's thumb. We saw a lot of this stuff in the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003, kind of came to the surface. You know, it's still there. There are all those notions that people, especially Catholics, especially, you know, and the German state after 1919, it's two-thirds Protestant, one-third Catholic. After 1945, it's half and half, pretty much. The Federal Republic was half and half. The Rhinelanders, people like Adenauer, they're very different from the old Prussian elite, from the Junker class, as it was called, the landed aristocracy in the East. These people are very sympathetic to this notion of mending fences with the West. But they are a minority within Germany. And most of the Germans are still quite nationalistic. You know, they had not given up on the kind of goals you saw during the war and prior to the war of Germany, you know, being a really major power, having control over its own destiny. The nationalists calculated that resistance made more sense than accommodation. Why? Because the forces arrayed against them were so weak. Right? It's not that they felt they had to resist because the peace terms were so harsh, because as I said last time, they were a lot harsher after 1945, but the chances of resisting successfully were much greater after 1919, because who's going to stop them? The Americans have defected. You know, the Americans are not going to maintain troops in Europe. This is not because of the defeat by the Senate of the League of Nations Covenant. The United States had ratified the Covenant. It wouldn't have made any difference at all, because you pursued the same policy within the League as without, was outside the League. And these decisions to withdraw from Europe, they were made by Wilson during the Wilson period. The British have turned against treaty system. The British are pressing for accommodation, for a softening of the treaty terms at the expense of France. They're not proposing to give back what they had gotten. Okay, the Germans, like, it's practically they wet their finger and put it to the wind. They see which way the winds are blowing. They sense that it's not going to take too much to throw off the shackles of Versailles. And when that happens, Germany could start to build up its power and become a strong military nation again. And once Germany is strong, then you could kind of talk to the rest of the world in a different voice. You could change the status quo in the East, etc., etc. So the predominant view in Germany is nationalistic view. And this has something to do with the internal structure of politics within Germany. This is a period when the old structure of legitimacy is broken down, and in particular, given the economic problems that Germany has to contend with in the post-1919 period, the industrialists, the captains of industry, what are called the Ruhr magnates, you know, like heavy industry, the production of steel and the production of machinery based on steel, this stuff still is the heart of the modern economy in Germany during that period. And the people who controlled the production of steel and the mining of iron ore and coal and all this sort of thing, the Ruhr magnates, they had disproportionate power in Germany during this period. And they took a very hard line. They were like quite nationalistic. Didn't have to be. You might have expected something somewhat different, but as it turned out, they were. And you know, like when the French are, I'll talk about this a little later, the French are proposing arrangements to enable the two countries to kind of work together economically and basically rebuild the devastated areas, you know, on a more business-like basis. And there were people in the German government, like their foreign minister in late 1920, his name is Siemens, and some of his key associates, who said we should not reject the outstretched hand of these French proposals. But the Ruhr magnates were dead set against this. I should say a little bit about the economic background of these things. There's a natural complementarity between France and Germany in the area of heavy industry and also in the overall economic area. Why is this the case? Because to produce steel, you need two things. You need iron ore or some form of iron. It could be scrap iron. And you also need coal, not a special type of coal that you could turn into metallurgical coke, because there's a chemical reaction between the iron that you smelt and the metallurgical coke that produces steel, right? So it turns out The Germans have vast deposits of very high quality coal that you could turn into metallurgical coke in the Ruhr. The small area here, just very close to the part of the Rhineland that the French are occupying. And the French produce iron ore. They produce a kind of iron ore called minette iron ore. It's not the top quality iron ore, but before the war, there was this, when the Germans controlled a lot of Lorraine, where these iron ore fields are located, the Germans would produce steel using this minette iron ore, right? And so the French said, well, basically, let's work together. Let's kind of, you have the coal, we have the iron ore, we'll work together in this area of heavy industry. Ruhr magnates disdainfully dismissed these French overtures. One of the main things I was going to tell you about, one of these guys, his name is Peter Kirchner. He was the head of a big steel firm. And when the French said, we'll give you the iron ore, and you give us the coal, and we'll have joint arrangements for the production of steel. Again, this is very much foreshadowing the famous Schuman Plan, 1950, after World War II, for a coal and steel community. And he says, let them choke on their minette, Kirchner says. We have other sources of iron. We have all the scrap iron around. We could import much higher quality iron ore from Sweden. It's true, the transport costs are a lot greater, but we don't need the French. Right. That's the attitude, because basically what it boils down to is Germany feels it's a stronger country than France, doesn't have to kowtow to France. The French are going to resist, but and Germany may have to pay a certain price in confronting France, but ultimately Germany's going to win. Right? That's the... All right, so what is the French policy in this area? You know, this harsh policy of forcing the Germans to pay, you know, squeezing the lemons, the German lemon until the pips squeak. That was from a phrase of a British cabinet minister during their national elections right after the war. The French didn't take that line at all. Okay? So I say they approached the Germans. The Germans aren't interested. This is both during the peace conference and late 1919. British aren't helpful. The British don't want a war between France and Germany, but they don't want relations between France and Germany to be too good either, because they don't want to either be part of the continent, and they don't want to be kind of squeezed out of the continent. So the British, their essential role during this period is to not encourage, and at two key points, to sabotage a Franco-German entente in this area. The treaty had various provisions which were simply not enforced. There was no fixed sum agreed to for the reparations at the peace conference. Instead, they set up this thing called the Reparation Commission that was supposed to kind of calculate what the bill would be by May of 1921 based on all these different categories of damage that were specified in the peace treaty. But Germany was supposed to pay in the intermediate period from the time the treaty was signed in June of 1919 until the schedule of payments was issued by the Reparation Commission in May of 1921, like a two-year period. And in that period, the Reparation Commission was supposed to lay out what Germany was supposed to pay by categories. There was a particular figure, about $5 billion, that Germany was supposed to pay. Well, nothing was done. No arrangement was given to the Germans. The Germans were supposed, according to Article 248 of the treaty, the reparations were supposed to be the first claim on German budgetary resources. Again, nothing was done to enforce this. And why was nothing done? And the answer there is the French wanted a business-like arrangement with Germany. They didn't want to simply lay down the law to the Germans. They wanted a kind of semi-consensual thing where the two sides would get together and work out how German resources could be used for the reconstruction of northern France. And I should say, all the stuff was very public at the time. The French government in 1920, the key figure there was the first prime minister, then he was president, his name is Mitterrand. He made it clear that he was interested in what his phrase, a policy of economic collaboration with Germany. French ambassador to Germany is a man named Charles Laurent. He was appointed because of his background in high finance and heavy industry, and the whole idea was to kind of work together with the Germans and work on some sort of arrangement which would facilitate the use of German resources for French reconstruction, so as to take the poison out of all this reparation business. And just and the climax of this policy comes at the end of 1920 with something called the Seydoux Plan. The whole Seydoux Plan, it had very modest figures for how much Germany would pay for the next few years, to make it easy for the Germans to pay. And the Germans were to be allowed to pay not in currencies that were convertible into gold, as provided by the Treaty of Versailles, but in their own currency, in paper marks. Why was this important? It was important because the main argument that Keynes had made to the effect that the Germans couldn't pay the reparations was not that Germany was incapable, in purely domestic economic terms, of generating the kind of surplus that could be used for these purposes. Keynes says, that's not the problem. It's not the internal economic problem of generating an economic surplus. It was rather the external economic problem of getting the foreign exchange needed to pay the reparation. Because there's one and only one way for Germany to get the foreign exchange. That's by selling more abroad than she imported from abroad. And who's going to buy these German goods? This is what Keynes said. You know, this is what he called the transfer problem. You know, how could the paper marks that Germany raised internally be transferred into the foreign currencies, convertible into gold, like the dollar, the pound, and so on, in which reparations had to be paid? He says, you tell me, Keynes said, I don't see it. Doesn't matter how much of a surplus Germany creates domestically, there's no way to transfer it. Therefore, the reparations are absurd. This is the argument of the economic consequences of the peace. I should say, it was revealed after World War II by the most distinguished American economist specializing in the theory of international trade, a man named Jacob Viner. He was writing a review of a book that was critical of the whole Keynes argument. He says, well, we economists, we specialists in international economics, we knew at the time that this Keynes argument was nonsense. But since we agreed with Keynes, almost to a man, about what needed to be done politically, we kept our mouths shut about the economics. You know, it's an important point. All right? The Seydoux Plan allows the Germans to pay in paper marks. It solves the transfer problem, not noticed by Keynes. Right? What happens with this plan? This is the closest France and Germany come in this period to an accommodation. A lot of Germans, like I said, in the government, their foreign minister and so on, were eager, in their phrase, not to reject the outstretched hand. And it was like touch and go. Because there were all kinds of reasons why a policy of accommodation with France made sense for Germany, right? It made sense to have better relations with France because the French would feel much more comfortable about easing up on the enforcement of the treaty, about moving toward treating you as an equal. It made sense because the policy of resisting the treaty led to the destruction of Germany's national finances and to this very serious problem of inflation that Germany had at the time. You want to put the economy on a sound basis, you want a business-like settlement if it's within reach at all. Plus, And maybe it made sense to reach an accommodation with France so you'd be strong enough to deal with the communist threat from the East and also to a certain extent the Anglo-Saxon threat from the West. There were a lot of people in Germany who were attracted to that way of thinking. Not a majority, however. The majority took a more nationalistic line. Maybe the balance could have been tipped in the opposite direction if the British had been more supportive of what the French were trying to do in this period, but they deliberately torpedoed it because they didn't like the idea of France and Germany getting too close. Okay. This is going to be a constant threat in British policy, well into the post-war period, in some ways even up to our own day. Okay, so you have the policy of the Seydoux plan being torpedoed essentially by the British in January of 21. A lot of opposition to the stuff on Germany's part. Did the French plunge headlong into a policy of enforcement, given that the treaty is not being enforced, that the Germans are not complying with it? Right. The answer there is no. Very slow to take action. You go through the entire year 1921, Germans aren't paying. 1922, Germans, a new government comes to power in France, headed by a much more tough-minded leader, Raymond Poincaré. And Poincaré, even he doesn't plunge directly into a military confrontation with Germany. Right, there's this real attempt to work things out, fails, and it's only in January 1923 that all this stuff comes to a head. Okay, just to give you French are trying to be quite accommodating with the Germans. For example, what are their demands on the whole question of coal? France doesn't produce all that much coal. There was a coal-producing area in northern France, but the mines were flooded by the Germans at the very end of the war with an idea toward crippling the French economy in the post-war period. The French felt they had a right to German coal because Germany produced so much of it and France needed so much of it. No one could say that there was a transfer problem there. Okay? How much coal did they want from the Germans? Their basic policy was insist that the deliveries be based on the principle of equal rates of satisfaction of needs for coal based on the consumption of coal in 1914 of areas that were now within the new post-war borders. They weren't asking for more than what the Germans would be allowed to have for themselves using that standard. Right? These are not the policies of a country that's eager to crush Germany under impossible reparations. Okay. But the very factors that led to French restraint, namely France's dependence in the long run on the Anglo-Saxon powers for her security, were sources of encouragement for Germany. It's not going to take too much. What's the basic German tactic here? You resist. You say, we can't pay. What's the proof you can't pay? We can't even cover our own internal expenses. Look at our problem of inflation, which is rooted in our inability to pay for our own internal expenses through taxation and so on. The fact that Germany has this big inflation problem, well, people say this is proof they can't pay. But the Germans deliberately allow the inflation problem to not be managed because they know it serves as a weapon for them in foreign policy terms. This has all been, all very clear from historical work over the last 20, 30 years or so. All right. So you have the Germans resisting, the French finally saying enough is enough. If we don't do anything, the whole Versailles system is going to go down the tubes. So they move into the Ruhr Basin, in January of 1923, leading to a crisis over the Ruhr. The Ruhr Crisis is the climax, not just of the dispute over reparations, but of the dispute in the early 1920s over the Versailles system, over whose power will dominate Europe. And how did the Ruhr Crisis run its course? Okay. The French move in, they send their troops in the Ruhr, and they issue these requisition orders for the coal to be delivered to France. All right. But the Germans essentially ignore these orders, and they reroute the trains and the barges and so on, so the coal continues to be delivered to unoccupied Germany, often by a roundabout route. And so the French say that we can't allow them to do this, so they cut off that possibility by blockading the Ruhr and preventing the export of all this coal. But in the meantime, the Ruhr miners are now national heroes in Germany because they are unwilling to cooperate with the French, and you can't allow them to starve because they're national heroes, so you allow them to continue working, and you give them money so that they can buy food and so on. This has a number of effects. First, it has the effect of transforming the German inflation of the wartime and immediate post-war period into the great hyperinflation of 1923, where it takes a wheelbarrow full of paper marks to buy a loaf of bread. The destruction of Germany's finances and the hyperinflation just throws the entire German economy into chaos with very important political repercussions. There are communist uprisings in Saxony and Thuringia. There was a Nazi putsch in Munich in 1923. There were separatist efforts in the Rhineland and so on. Very serious political problems for Germany. And as far as the coal itself is concerned, the miners are being paid. The French have no way of, at the beginning, of getting the coal into France. So the coal just piles up in these huge mountains at the pit heads. And so all the French need to do is solve the transport problem in order to get the coal from the Ruhr into France, which they eventually do. And with all of these problems and the failure of the German resistance to the policy, the Germans are at their wits' end. And finally, in August of 1923, in the eighth month of the Ruhr occupation, the German government basically approaches the French and say, okay, we give up. What do you want us to do to kind of get the coal deliveries into Germany going again and so on, right? And the French had the chance now to say, well, what we want you to do is to do X, Y, Z, get your finances in order, allocate a certain amount for the reparations, and so on and so on and so on. They won't do anything like that. Why not? Because they're tempted by the idea of Germany's falling apart. Let the process continue. Let Germany fall apart. Let the kind of separatist tendencies, especially in the Rhineland, run their course. And so they turn a deaf ear to these German proposals. This is tantamount to snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, because they don't have it within themselves to allow this process to go to its ultimate conclusion, which would be mass starvation throughout Germany, revolution throughout Germany, and so on. And instead, they pull back from the brink when the British and the Americans offer to step in and offer to kind of help financially both countries get back on their feet. But there is a price that has to be paid for this. They have to promise that there aren't going to be any more Ruhr occupations. The use of force to compel compliance with the treaty, out of the question now. And the Americans and the British do come in. This is something called the Dawes Plan in 1924. Right? Dawes was an American banker, played a key role in American political life. Right? Germans are going to be given a loan. They're able to stabilize their currency. The French are able now to kind of get something in the way of reparations. Okay, But basically, France lost the political struggle. Does this, does, but does France's defeat mean that Germany's victory? The answer there is no. And here, I mean, all these things, they're just so interesting because you tend to think of these things in zero-sum terms, but you can't. Because Germany is also constrained. Germany can't move headlong toward revolting against the treaty, toward not complying with the treaty all across the board, even though the French had promised not to use force against them. Why? Because the German mark is stabilized at a level where Germany is dependent on continuing imports of foreign capital into Germany, from Britain and even more from America. Okay, and because if that flow of capital dries up, there's no way of sustaining the exchange rate at the level that had been established in late 1923. Okay. And if the mark can't be sustained, it would have to be devalued. Well, that would, just trigger all these fears of here we go again. You know, new round of inflation. The inflation was like this nightmare. You know, I mean, to the present day, the Germans are big believers in sound money because of the horrors of the inflation of 1923. So the Germans are dependent on pursuing a policy which does not run the risk of compromising that flow of capital. They need the flow to continue. That hems in what they could do. They're not reconciled to the Versailles system by any means. And they want to continue resisting it. But to resist it, they have to move in a more subtle way. Not to rebel against it, not to rise up against it. You know, pursue a policy of, you know, the key figure in German policy in the late 20s, Gustav Stresemann, he had this term, finanzieren, to finesse things. We've got to finesse things. Pull the wool over their eyes. Talk the good talk. Make it seem like we're the good Europeans. Right? We're going to play their game, and we're going to say that if, as long as we use this language, the we're interested in reconciliation, you know, we want to put all these conflicts behind us, then they'll give us what we want. But even so, we're not going to play the game 100%, and we will continue to use whatever sources of leverage are at our disposal. So that, for example, Germany continues to use the threat of a Russo-German Entente as a means of extracting more concessions from the West. This had been German policy in the early 1920s. You all know there's a famous treaty, the Treaty of Rapallo, 1922, between Germany and Russia. Basically, the Germans are saying, if you're too hard on us, you'll drive us over to the side of the Soviets. We'll form, you know, common bloc against you. You know, so you better ease up with us. That same policy is pursued in the post-Ruhr period. Yeah?
Earlier you said that America and British stepped in and wanted to loan money to the Germans.
Correct.
For financing.
Yeah.
Why didn't they do that to France?
Well, the French were, in effect, getting the money, because if Germany is back on her feet, then Germany would be able to take some of that money and send it over to France, right? And then the French would be able to take some of that money and send it back to America in repayment for the war loans. A lot of people thought this is just kind of a crazy stuff. Yeah?
Was that the main reason that they lost the political, you know, fight in the war crisis, or was it that they allowed the American and British intervention, or that they didn't allow the Germans to fall?
They wouldn't push their policy to the bitter end, because they just drew back from the thought of mass starvation in Germany. It's a revolution throughout Germany. But you see, it's like this kind of mindlessness. They're not thinking it through. People think, oh, well, everything is just the structure of the system. But statecraft really matters. Well, I'm out of time now. Let me begin next time with the Stresemann policy in the late 1920s and go into the early Hitler period.